617 Seattle's Morning News. Good to have you tuned in. We hear a lot of discussion on the campaign trail about Medicaid, Medicare for all, but do we have the money or the organizational expertise to pull off a complete overhaul of the healthcare system? We called up 6th District Congressman Derek Kilmer, who sits on the House Appropriations Committee.
To me, the two big public policy questions that get wrapped up in the sort of single-payer conversation are, one, what does it mean in terms of people's ability to get access to care? So, for example, I represent the Olympic Peninsula and a lot of rural providers, and I've asked each one of the hospitals in my district, so tell me about your payer mix and where do you make money and where do you lose money? They take a bath on Medicaid, most of them. They lose money, and they lose money on Medicare as well. They generally make it up on commercial payers, on private pay, and on people who have employer-provided insurance. What I've asked them is, so what if we just moved everyone to Medicare? And the response has been, if we do that without a substantial increase in reimbursement, we're in real trouble, because right now we lose money on Medicare patients. The second big question is, if you're going to tell 160 million Americans who get insurance through their employer that they're going to have that taken away from them, you have to be ready to ensure them that it's going to be a better and perhaps more affordable plan than what they have now. I haven't seen that answered clearly, that it would be a better plan. My personal take is, one, as a Democrat, I am absolutely for universal health care, making sure that everyone in this country has access to quality, affordable health care. Paul Krugman did a great piece where he said there's multiple paths to that. Single payer may be one, but there's other paths like what he looked at, the Dutch system, for example, where he indicated that he called that Obamacare done right, where you have, in essence, the protections of the Affordable Care Act, you have employer-provided health care, and then you have Medicare for all who want it, in essence, a public option, which I've been supportive of, the notion that if someone doesn't want health care through their employer, doesn't have access to that, they're able to get health care through one of the public systems, whether that be Medicaid or Medicare.
Well, going back to what you were saying about your conversations with rural hospitals in your district, that's exactly what I have not heard from most of the Democrats who talk about Medicare for all. And I'm glad that you talked to them, because what I hear is exactly what they told you, that the reason Medicare works is because there are so many people who are not on it and who are paying full freight so the hospitals can afford to take the Medicare patients. Because Medicare for all doesn't just mean covering everybody. It means covering them at an artificially low rate at which the hospitals cannot make money. So at some point, I'm curious, when you run into some of the people running for president around the Capitol, do you point this out to them, that you can't simply promise Medicare for all unless you find out what the actual effect is going to be on the hospitals?
Well, we've invited, I chair a coalition in the Congress, and we've invited every presidential candidate to come and meet with us. And I think that's, the discussion around how do we provide access to quality, affordable health care is going to be part of that conversation, which, again, I actually am pretty excited about that. It is such a fundamental contrast to the previous few years that I'd been in Congress, where all of the discussion was around how health care was going to be taken away from people and how protections were going to be taken away from patients. The reality is 100% of Democrats in the House believe that we need to provide more access to more quality, affordable health care. And there's going to be a debate and discussion about how best to do that. I actually think it's great that these bills are having hearings, that there's multiple solutions on the table. What an amazing contrast to the previous few years. So part of my job is to make sure that I'm protecting the interests of the folks that I represent. I want to make sure, I have talked to too many people who feel like they're an illness away or an accident away from financial despair. I've talked to too many people who've gone through that process. And I would also mention, and we've talked about this before, part of the equation also has to be around improving access to prescription drugs. I think you will see in the weeks ahead an effort to bring forward a bill that's focused on that, most likely through price negotiation, as is done under Medicaid and under the VA. So there's a lot of issues wrapped up in healthcare, and thankfully, because the House is under new management, you're actually starting to see some forward motion on this stuff.
I am curious, we're talking about the presidential candidates, do you see them much around the Capitol? And at some point, do you end up endorsing one of them? And can you jeopardize other friendships by endorsing someone?
Well, it's an unusual position to be able to count a number of presidential candidates as friends, and I really do. A number of them are colleagues, a number of them are former colleagues, and I've got one that's a constituent. Jay Inslee, I see right. the most. In fact, he walked with us in the 4th of July parade on Bainbridge Island. And
was he?
I'm very excited.
Was he whispering into your ear? How about an endorsement, Derek?
Oh, I gave it to him.
You did? You know, okay.
I am enthusiastic about both his focus on climate, but him being a spokesman for the state of Washington and some of the successful policies we've had here in the state of Washington.
It hasn't caught on, though, nationally, has it?
My hope is that we're going to see a debate that gives a little bit more time to some of the serious candidates in the months ahead. And I think Governor Inslee has a lot to add to that debate, frankly, not just around climate change, but around some of the economic success we've seen here in the state of Washington.
Sixth District Congressman Derek Kilmer. Seattle's Morning News. Artificial intelligence, of course, is having a big effect on medical care, including in diagnosis. And now there seems to be some promise in using artificial intelligence to take an existing electrocardiogram and discover minute but significant details that a human physician cannot see. Let's consult the doctor.
Agent Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So how far along is this AI technology?
There was a study done, some research done recently at the Mayo Clinic, where they were able to combine artificial intelligence to assess electrocardiograms. Now, let's keep in mind, the electrocardiogram is the EKG or the, you know, what we see on the monitor on TV or if we go into the hospital. So it's a really widely available test in even the poorest regions of the world. And it's one of the first tests because it just simply measures the electrical activity of the heart. But there are some things that just can't be well diagnosed by an electrocardiogram, and one is the function of the heart. So the heart not only has its electrical activity, but it also has its functional activity, how well it squeezes and how well it relaxes. And so heart failure is really when the pump effect, the squeezing effect of the heart fails over time. And there are over 5 million Americans, 5 to 7 million Americans every year that are affected by heart failure. And there's not really a good way of screening them. So, you know, typically if you want to screen somebody for heart failure, it requires a battery of tests. It not only requires an electrocardiogram, but it would also require an echocardiogram, which is using ultrasound waves to look at the function of the heart. There are certain blood tests that we can do. And so it's usually a combination of things like that that are used to make the diagnosis. So the notion that we could take a simple electrocardiogram and using artificial intelligence to more thoroughly evaluate the electrical signal to tell us other information about the function of the heart would really be a remarkable step forward.
So to be clear, this is taking the same kind of heart track that you and I have seen many times, and because the artificial intelligence has access to so much data and can parse it so minutely, it can actually foresee a possible problem that even a trained cardiac surgeon like yourself might not have seen?
That's correct. This took place at the Mayo Clinic. They hypothesized that patients who are asymptomatic for having left ventricular dysfunction, or left ventricle is the side of the heart that pumps blood to our body, so left ventricular dysfunction, that they could reliably detect in the electrocardiogram itself failure of the left ventricle if they had a properly trained neural network.
So as a physician yourself, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that it's inevitable that computers, they play an increasingly important role in our life, and they're certainly going to play an increasingly important role in how physicians work and with their diagnostic skills and evaluation skills. I don't think that computers will ever replace humans, because I think there's some really important components to healthcare that just can't be replaced by a computer. But there are still many, many things that a computer can do. And so I think that artificial intelligence can play an important role. And there's been some other studies that have actually done this. One interesting study that was done was at the University of Southern California, where the psychiatrists there were wondering, could they get more information out of a patient would if they used an avatar for a patient to speak to instead of a physician, instead of a real person. And the results were astounding. It was clear that people were far more readily willing to tell an avatar their deepest secret where they wouldn't a human. So some people actually saw this as a potential breakthrough, because if people were willing to communicate with avatars, they could get more information that can then be used to treat a patient and their underlying psychological or psychiatric problems. But, you know, the other role for artificial intelligence isn't going to be just in communication. It's going to be helping in decision-making. And IBM invested heavily in Watson, and Watson's goal was to help doctors in their decision-making. And their first implementation of Watson into the medical community was in the area of cancer or oncology. And they set it up with some of the biggest cancer hospitals in the country to have IBM and Watson assist them in their care for patients who are going through cancer treatment. But I think that where it's going to really play a role is as an extension of what IBM did, which is just helping doctors save time. If a computer or using artificial intelligence can do the original screening of a patient, so that when a patient starts to interact, maybe online, maybe on a computer in an office prior to seeing the doctor, that a lot of the screening and information can be done and help direct the doctor into exactly the right direction. And then the doctor, with the art part of medicine, rather than just the science part, but the art part, can then help to take care of the patient more effectively and in a more time-efficient way.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Carlene O'Brien. And it's time for CBS News Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, good morning. And first of all, this story about Deutsche Bank reorganizing, laying off people. Is this just a problem unique to Deutsche Bank? Because every time I hear about some bank in trouble, I immediately flash back to 2008. I assume it's nothing like that, right?
I'm sorry. I don't want you to have that flashback. I know that's very upsetting. This is a Deutsche Bank problem. It's kind of interesting in many respects, because Deutsche Bank, like a lot of European banks, decided it wanted to make a big push into the U.S. market. Now, what they would see is they'd see all these big American banks doing huge deals, and they wanted to get in on that. This is probably about 20 years ago, and big banks like Deutsche Bank, like UBS, like Credit Suisse, they went on a big spending spree. They bought other U.S. smaller investment banks. They created huge opportunities, and they just expanded like crazy in the U.S. And 20 years later, what they're finding is that from the problems of the financial crisis and mismanagement, they simply cannot actually operate in the United States as they thought they could have. And a lot of that had to do with some problems at Deutsche Bank specifically, or Credit Suisse or UBS. It may have been because of poor management, but also because they were caught up in the European debt crisis, the Greek debt crisis, in a way that many U.S. banks weren't. And to some observers like me, it seems like Deutsche Bank is now doing a lot of the work that it probably should have done 10 years ago.
So nothing to worry about. The other thing I saw was statistics on the amount of credit card debt people have. The average balance is now up to $6,553 as of May. It's been sort of rising gradually. Is there any reason for concern there?
You know, I'm always concerned about this, but in a strange way, a lot of debt being piled on at this point can sometimes lead economists to say, well, people are feeling confident, or people have jobs, or, gee, they feel like they can borrow again after not being able to do so. I think it's always worth watching. A couple of things about debt. We also got a survey out from the Associated Press that shows that 1 in 4 Americans say that they just never are going to retire. I think part of that is because they're carrying this debt load. And another piece of the debt load has to do with student loans. And with $1.5 trillion of outstanding student loan debt, when you're paying that off, sometimes you borrow from Peter to pay Paul. And that can be that you have consumer debt through credit cards because you're scared that you're going to miss a payment on your student loan debt. So I think that overall, household debt levels are not alarming this minute, but I think what is alarming is that some families, if you drill down, are feeling incredible pressure because of the debt loads they assume.
And we still have a strong economy, right? We had a good jobs report. Overall, the numbers remain strong.
Yeah, there are two parts of what the Federal Reserve is really focusing on, and one was the labor market. And we know that in May we had a kind of a dim report, only 72,000 jobs created. In June, 224,000 jobs, so that's a big uptick. We know the unemployment rate remains near this 50-year low, 3.7%. Wages are up. They're not huge, but they are up 3.1% from a year ago. I think the concern from the Federal Reserve's point of view and economists is that overall, we are seeing a little bit of a softening in the economy, and we see that most specifically in the inflation data. Because if the economy were really going great guns, you'd see prices start to accelerate. And we don't want too much inflation, but we don't want too little either. I know that sounds weird, but just imagine if prices are stagnant or even drifting lower, and you're a consumer, and you say, I got to buy a TV. And you say, let me wait, because prices are drifting down. That waiting is a real bad sign for the economy, because if we wait to do things, that can actually indicate that we're heading into a sluggish growth period.
One more thing, going back to college loans, there are scams out there. Give us a heads up on that.
Yeah, this is just an awful scam. This is imposters posing as people from the Department of Education. And what they are promising is you can eradicate all of your student loans, cancel them, restructure them. Just send us money up front. You must act now. Now, I say it that way, and it sounds kind of silly, like who would believe that? But I've listened to these. They are phone messages, they are texts, they are emails, they are online advertisements, and they are compelling. It sounds like someone from the Department of Education. They'll say something like, you know, Obama-era education lending rules are changing. Contact us immediately for more. And if you get that message and you owe money to the government for a federal student loan, you might call back or you might answer the phone. And the problem is that, number one, it is illegal to charge upfront fees for student loan debt services. Number two, that act now is certainly a little bit of a red flag. Number three, student loans can never be easily canceled or dismissed in any way, shape, or form. And so if you hear of anything like this and you start to get messages around this, just say no. Do not give any important information out about yourself, about your loans. It is rampant there. The FTC has teamed up with the Department of Education, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They really want people to be aware that this scam is gaining a lot of speed.
CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
A King County Sheriff's deputy and a State Patrol trooper are being commended for their quick thinking while off the clock. Cairo Radio's Dean Seaman reports.
Back on June 17th, Barry Madsen was getting ready for class at Phantom Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in Maple Valley. Two of his neighbors, King County Sheriff's Deputy Chris Kyle and State Patrol Trooper Kareem Bukabu, were also there. Madsen felt everything was normal for the most part.
I felt a little bit lightheaded during the class. I would say it's comparable to if you haven't ate anything all day and you kind of stand up too quick. And so I just chalked it up to, well, I need to drink some more water. It was one of our little hotter days here starting up in the summer.
The class began with warm-ups and drills before they went into active sparring.
I was supposed to roll with somebody else, and I just decided I was going to pick Deputy Kyle because him and I are about the same size, and the other person I was supposed to roll with was a little bit smaller, quite a bit smaller than me.
Less than 1 minute in, Kyle noticed something was wrong.
He had got me in a foothold, and I got him in an ankle lock, and all of a sudden he stopped. And I'm like, well, that's weird. So I stopped, and I'm just kind of waiting for him to do something. It wasn't moving. So I sat up, and then he had I looked at his eye, and he had a thousand-yard stare, and his eyes were extremely dilated.
They thought Madsen was suffering from a seizure, but when Madsen stopped breathing, Kyle noticed his heart stopped. He went into cardiac arrest. Kyle started chest compressions before medics arrived to use a defibrillator. All the while, Trooper Bukabu worked with others to coordinate help and stayed with Barry's kids.
The whole time now, I was trying to coordinate with Barry, trying to get a hold of his family. His wife was pregnant. And then so I actually called my wife and, like, go to their house and get them and bring them here.
Madsen was revived and taken to a nearby hospital, and tests have been done since then.
I've had, you know, an angiogram, electrical physiology test, and a heart MRI, and there's still no known cause. The doctors tell me it's less than 1% chance that it will ever happen again, but I'm still going to get an internal defibrillator put in.
But Madsen believes he just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Anybody else there, I'm most likely would not be around. But the other crazy part is that it wasn't exercise-induced. I could have just as easily been at home when it happened, or out walking the dog.
Both Deputy Kyle and Trooper Bukabu have received honors from their agencies for their quick thinking. Kyle says the biggest reward is seeing his neighbor alive and happy, a reward not necessarily possible with other calls.
He's got two small boys now, and he just had his third child, you know, and he's my age. So knowing that he's able to be there and be a dad is the best thing you can ever wish for.
Yeah, absolutely the best reward. Talk about being a good neighbor. Holy moly.
Yeah, and out of the blue.
Yeah.
And no cost.
It happens once in a while. Yeah.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, direct from 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. So Team USA and Megan Rapinoe today.
USA.
World Cup champions.
It ain't cocky if you can back it up.
That's right. Well, then
it's confidence, not arrogance.
But what about the equal pay issue? Because right after the victory was declared, they started chanting equal pay. And the women are asking why the men get paid more. And, of course, they're always told because the men draw better and bring in more money.
Yes. And that there's a significantly larger pool of prize money that FIFA, the global governing body, allocates for the men's World Cup as opposed to the women's World Cup. I think it's a fascinating debate because they are the same job.
Right.
Same job.
Well, but, I mean, in broadcasting, doing the same job at a bigger station makes you more money, right? I mean, so
that's correct.
Everywhere. So are the women being paid a fair proportion of the revenue they bring in, or
I would say that the women deal with things that, and this has started to change, the things that are absolutely unfair that they deal with are the playing surfaces that they'll mm-hmm. play on, that there are times that they are asked to play on either artificial turf or grass surfaces that the men would never be expected or asked to play on, travel arrangements, that their travel arrangements are significantly different, the scheduling, the ways that they are accommodated are significantly different. And I still think that there's room to have a discussion. They're the same job. And just because one is it should gender determine, should gender limit how much you can earn for that?
Well, here's my other question. We were talking about aggregate revenue, but according to the Wall Street Journal, since the World Cup in 2015, the women's team has generated more revenue than the men's games.
I'm not sure about that. And I'd have to look at how they determine that, because that's pretty hard to parse. And that strikes me as unlikely.
And maybe that's a problem, too, if it's that difficult to figure out who's making what.
Well, that's always the case in professional sports, is that owners will always tell you that the players get more than their fair share, and the way that they determine it. And there's all sorts of accounting tricks for owners to hide how much they are making or how much it's costing them. And you also have franchise fees. This is a little different because there's no franchise fee.
But most people would agree that the women are just getting paid less.
Yes.
But not by much. According to the Washington Post today, they make 89% of the men is the number that they're under the new collective bargaining agreement that took.
Not 100%
right,
of what they're making.
Right. When you hear pay gap, a lot of people think, oh, it's like 50% or 20. It's 89%, according to the Washington Post, with an article today that went through all of the details. It just got posted a little bit ago, and I read it. And it's based on the fact that the men play for bonuses. They don't have a salary. The women's team have a guaranteed salaries that are paid, but the problem is the bonus structure from FIFA is so out of whack,
completely skewed,
that the men can make more,
they get a lot of money
under FIFA.
But what's maddening here is the women's team is so outstanding, and we wouldn't even be talking about soccer if it wasn't for the women's team. Let's be honest.
Well, I think that there's an honest, first of all, the Washington Post, I'm going to bet that is skewed because the men's team just did not qualify for the World Cup.
No, this is just based on the new collective bargaining agreement agreements that went into effect in 2016.
But if it's men playing for bonuses, there's a huge bonus that they would not have been paid because they didn't qualify for the last World Cup.
That is also true. Probably, it's the bonus structure that seems way off, but that's a FIFA issue, not a U.S. women's team.
But again, the women are kicking butt on the pitch, and the men we don't even talk about, and that's what is glaring to me.
Well,
when you see the women on the world stage being so successful and so admired and putting our country's attention on soccer, and the men are not there.
In this country, and I would say places in general, and this is not a judgment of whether it's right or wrong, that the salaries are not determined by excellence. The salaries are determined by the revenue that they generate. Right. And that's not necessarily fair. And I think that there are some serious questions people should ask. To me, the question isn't, should the women be paid according to how dominant they are? The question is, when we have men and women representing the country and doing the same job, are we comfortable as a country and having a gender pay gap based on the fact that the women generate fewer revenue, less revenue, that there's a smaller pool of money for a variety of reasons out there? And you can debate all those. And for me, I think it's the same job, and I think it should get the same pay. I think the moment that you start tying it to performance in that way.
No, but I think that's why we're paying so much attention to it. It just seems so off kilter when you've got women who are such professional athletes,
sure,
so good at what they do.
And but WNBA players don't make as much money as the NBA players.
That's also a problem in my book.
To me, that's a little bit different because that's a professional sport. It's not a national governing body. And what would stop someone who plays in lacrosse, the Seattle Stealth, their lacrosse team, or their rugby team, the Seawolves, from saying, hey, we're better at our sport than the Seahawks are? We generally determine revenue based on salary based on how much revenue a sport determines, that you're able to negotiate and command whatever piece of the pie that your sport generates, but it's not, we're not going to regulate it across. It is different when you get into, in my mind, national teams.
Well, the fans could change this. If, for example, fans stopped watching NBA games and watched exclusively WNBA games, and the men lost all their endorsements, the women got them all.
I don't think it would change that much. I really don't think it would change.
Sure,
I think there's a systemic issue going on here. There's less money, as you pointed out, pool of money to draw from for the women's teams, and until that changes, it's not going to change.
You got to get butts in the seats.
I don't think that, I don't disagree with what Heather's saying.
More people watch the 2015 World Cup women's game than any soccer match in U.S. history.
Right, that's U.S., but we're talking about you got to get butts in the seats all the time.
I don't disagree with what Heather's saying. I think the question comes, how do you enforce that? Or how do you agree with that?
Equal pay for equal work.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.